Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Connolly, Judge Bjorkman, Honorable James P. Flory present.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Please be seated. First case on today's calendar is Delfino versus Medtronic, court file 18-1462. As counsel is aware, you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please begin your arguments by identifying yourselves for the record. I note that there's two counsel on each side here. Are you going to be splitting time or?
No.
All right. And counsel for appellant may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Tim Becker. I'm from the law firm of Johnson Becker, and I represent Ms. Delfino. With me today is my associate, Janelle Shannon, who also participated in the briefing.
So I can assume, we can assume she did all the work then.
If you liked it. let me start with just the general overviews of preemption. A plaintiff is required to establish two things in order to evade preemption, and those are, first, he or she, in this case she, must point to a parallel federal regulation or rule that the defendant violated, and second, that violation must be the cause of his or her particular harm. Now, the principal brief that we set forth a series of violations and deviations that we think identify where Medtronic loses its preemption defense. I'd like to focus today on two of those. Those two are, first, the deviation related to specification 0114546, which deals with the construction and development of the end terminations in the capacitor that was used in this particular product. And the second deviation I'd like to focus on are certain performance standards that Medtronic failed to achieve.
And is that, by that, you mean the projected service life?
Well, so there are a series of performance standards, Your Honor, that we lay out in the brief, one of which relates specifically to service life in terms of years. That is not the one I want to focus on today. The two that I'd like to focus on relate to voltage drainage, which is found in the PMA, and then the second relates to battery depletion or capacitor depletion, which is found in the 0114546 specification. So turning our attention to the first deviation, specification 0114546 clearly states that the end terminations shall consist of plated tin over a nickel barrier. Three documents, at least, within the record identify that that is how the end terminations are to be constructed. The first, of course, is the specification itself. The second is document 38, which was an internal assessment by Medtronic, which referred to the specification, the capacitors, as requiring construction of end terminations in a particular way. The third was the deposition of Nancy Willems, Medtronic's corporate representative, who testified that the specification read as it does, which is that it requires the end terminators to be constructed with this plated tin over nickel barrier. And finally, Medtronic's own brief in connection with his motion for summary judgment refers to the configuration as end termination. So we think...
But all the diagrams I saw on the record indicated just that, that the end terminations of the capacitor were plated tin over nickel, and then there was a layer of copper behind that. Is that a correct understanding here, Mr. Becker?
So that, I think, Your Honor, I think you've hit on a particular issue that that is related to this. It depends upon what you mean by end terminations, right? So what Medtronic says is we think end terminations means what you have just articulated. But we point to three additional documents along with testimony from their corporate representative that says end terminations means something entirely different. So if the issue comes down to what is an end termination and how is it constructed and what is included in it, then that is a fact issue that the district court inappropriately decided, because there's varying viewpoints on what it means to be an end termination. But broader speaking, I don't think that particularly matters for this reason. What Medtronic is really arguing with respect to this deviation is that It's what I refer to as the anything not expressly precluded is allowed requirement. There is no doubt that a capacitor requires a dielectric in order to operate. You just articulated, Judge Foley, or Flory, in your question to me what that dielectric in this case was, and it was copper. But you could use copper, you could use nickel. There's several different base metals that can be used in, when constructing a capacitor, and those dielectrics are part and parcel of the end termination. So the question for you today is...
Or that's a fact issue, I think.
That's a...
According to you, that's a fact issue.
We believe that's part of the end termination, but at a minimum, we think that's a fact issue in terms of how what constitutes the end termination. Does it include the dielectric, or does it just include the cap, the plated tin over nickel?
Very end.
Correct. So ultimately, what Medtronic is saying with respect to its use of this porous copper is that because it was not expressly precluded by FDA, it is therefore deemed allowed.
So is your argument that any copper was used? Because I read your brief to say any copper of any kind would be a violation of the PMA, or is it because some of these devices had porous copper? I don't think we would be here if this one supplier hadn't used porous copper.
So
I'm just wondering, are you claiming that any type of copper, porous or not, is a violation here, or only the porous that we're dealing with in this case?
So the straightforward answer to your question, Your Honor, is yes. Our argument is what is not expressly allowed in the PMA is expressly prohibited. And so by using...
But what case or statutory language supports that interpretation?
So let me tick those off fairly quickly.
Right ahead, sir.
First, there is the canon of construction related to the use, shall. Shall as, and this is by analogy, obviously not a statute. Shall means must. So the way that it, there is no language.
You know, in all due respect, I used to think that. And then in a Supreme Court case that reversed me, the district court, I was alerted to the fact that shall sometimes means other things, and sometimes it doesn't even mean shall. So... But go ahead, sir.
I appreciate you. I've had similar experiences.
Yeah. Well, let's not go down that road today.
So there is case law in Minnesota that's laid out in our brief that shall means must, and there is nothing in the specification that entitles them to use copper as the dielectric. So three other things that I want to point out, too, which kind of round out why copper without being told or permitted to be used is disapproved. The first is...
Has it ever been disapproved by the FDA or the FDCA or anybody? I mean, I found that curious that we're in this lawsuit alleging a violation of the pre-market approval process, but I could find nothing in the record where the approving authority has said, yes, this process has been violated, we need to recall these products or anything like that. Why is that not part of it, this record? What am I not understanding?
First and foremost, the product was recalled in this, at least those related to the porous copper. Secondly, here's how we view preemption in light of the regulations. If you choose to deviate from the PMA, you may never have a problem. So in this context, Medtronic uses copper. And if they had only used copper and there had never been a problem, there may have been a technical deviation, but there would be no corresponding harm because no one got hurt. The trade-off in exchange from the manufacturer and the trade-off that the Supreme Court articulated in Regal and that Congress enveloped in the MDA, in our view, is this. If you follow the rules, so let's say you play the game Mousetrap. If you go along the board and you build the mousetrap as you're supposed to, then you cannot be sued. You crank up the crank, the ball falls through the tub, the guy falls into the trap comes down, you win. Now, if you decide to not have a certain piece in the game of mousetrap, you still may be able to catch the mouse, but you are now taken out of the realm of being immunized from suit because you have deviated from what you were authorized to do and how you told the FDA what you were intending to do when building the product. And here's
my,
how you...
My concern is that there doesn't seem to be a dispute, in fact, that in fact the very end was nickel over... nickel over tin or tin over nickel, whatever that was.
Right.
But there's no question about, no disputed facts about that.
That's
so
correct.
The only question is whether the fact that copper then was the next layer violated the PMA.
Right.
And is that, I guess the fundamental question in my mind is whether the claimed PMA violation issue is one of law or fact.
Well, we're going to know that in about 3 months when the Supreme Court rules on Fosamax. Right, our view, not surprisingly, Your Honor, is that the Third Circuit got it right in Fosamax, and that it is a question of fact. Certainly, there, I look at it as sort of akin to, for a poor analogy, resolution of contracts. Step one is that the court sort of figures out, does a contract exist and is it ambiguous? And step two, then, is those issues upon setting the parameters go to the jury to figure out whether or not the contract was breached. So certainly the court articulates what the scope of the violation would be, but whether a violation occurred, we believe, much like the Third Circuit decided in Fosamax, is an issue that is ultimately reserved for the jury. And so in the context of this case, to go back to the original question of how do you get to what is not expressly allowed, is implicitly or expressly excluded, there are three portions of the code we cite to that we think read collectively get there. The first is 21 U.S.C. 360E C1B, which says you, manufacturer, to get PMA approval, have to give us a full list of the component parts, and how you're going to build this product. So they didn't do that, according to how we view the facts, because there's nothing that tells us this copper is going to be the dielectric, or that porous copper is going to be the dielectric. Number two, we point to 21 U.S.C. 360 ED 6A1 from 2012. This is also cited in Regal 2. And these codes change all the time, but or their numbering. But that says, if you want to change a material in the device, you have to tell us, manufacturer, us being FDA. And the third is the supplementation requirements required under 21 CFR 814.39A. Read collectively, what that means is this in our mind. You have to tell us how you're going to build the product and what products you intend to use to do so. And if you don't, you proceed at your own risk. Nothing may ever happen, as with the copper. You may manufacture this product and have no harm. But if the harm emanates from a material that you never told us about, you have now violated these rules. And the reason for that is this. The societal exchange we were talking about in Regal relates to a trade-off of, we recognize class 3 devices are inherently dangerous. You have a heart pump. If it fails, the outcome is going to be catastrophic. And Congress said, we can live with that catastrophic outcome provided the manufacturer does what they're supposed to do. One thing of which is, tell us how are you going to build the product and what materials are you going to use. And where the manufacturer does that, they're immunized from suit. But where the manufacturer doesn't do that, they are not. And the reason for that is simple. You can't test or do clinical trials, or evaluate the safety and efficacy of a alloy that FDA has no knowledge of. So that's why the failure to tell FDA how you intend to build the product, excuse me, and what you intend to do or what materials you intend to use is so important. Let me just note one technical thing. Medtronic raises an argument about the specification not being a part of the PMA, so we don't even get to these issues. I just want to call to your attention on pages 7 and 9 of our brief. There is a typo. The section references 814.39. The actual quotation is to 814.9. What that section says is that the PMA file includes all data, and information submitted or incorporated by reference into the PMA or the PMA application, Medtronic itself concedes that the 115, 114546 specification was referred to in the PMA. This regulation gets you through that door. I have 40 seconds left. I'm going to talk really quickly about performance standards. Performance standards are binding. They're binding under the CFR at, I believe it's 861, 21 CFR 861.1. FDA can and does impose performance standards all the time in Class 3 devices. The FDA itself, in the Horn decision, took the position, this is the Bush FDA, so certainly no friend of plaintiffs, that they are in charge and can perform performance standards. And finally, and then I'll sit down, the very statute that Medtronic and the Walker Court cite to require the rulemaking process does not apply to Class 3 devices by its very terms. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Becker. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor. Andrew Tauber on behalf of Medtronic. Although plaintiff has tried to muddy the water, there is no genuine dispute of a material fact. Plaintiff has offered no admissible evidence of a PMA violation. While, of course, eager to answer any questions that the court might have, there are three principal points that I would like to make today. The capacitor specification, 014546, which I'll call capacitor specification for ease of conversation, the capacitor specification is not part of the PMA, does not establish ongoing performance requirements, and does not prohibit the use of copper.
So this isn't submitted?
No, ma'am, it is
along
not.
Along with and other, well, then what are the PMA materials?
The PMA materials are voluminous. They are thousands of pages.
And they don't include the specifications for the device?
Your Honor, I understand that the device is a complex device with many components. This particular component, the X5R capacitor, was one component within a hybrid, which was then placed inside the ICD. And Medtronic is not the expert in capacitor manufacture. It contracts with a supplier, and the supplier is the one who is the expert in that process, and it is the one who manufactured. And so what Medtronic submitted to the FDA as part of the voluminous PMA submission was detailed descriptions of the overall operation of the ICD, that is, the device here that's about, you know, the capacitor is merely a component of the ICD. So Medtronic submitted voluminous material about the design of the overall IC device, pointed to then a bill of materials which lists what will be in that device. And let me just stop there for a second. So the first part of what I was talking about, these voluminous materials, those are clearly submitted to the FDA, no dispute. Then in those voluminous materials describing the ICD as a whole, there was a reference to another document which was not submitted to the FDA called the Bill of Materials, which referenced in the PMA lists what the materials will be. In it, there's a reference to the capacitors, and there's then a further reference in that document, which was never given to the FDA, to the capacitor specification. So what we have here is a capacitor specification that is 2 degrees of separation from the materials that were submitted to the FDA. And counsel, I don't think intentionally, but nonetheless misspoke when he said that we concede that this was incorporated by reference in the PMA. We absolutely do not concede that point.
So why wasn't Kemet sued here then, if that's the claim? If the claim is maybe Kemet used the porous copper that they shouldn't used in our capacitor and that caused voltage drainage, why aren't they a party here?
That would be a question for plaintiff's counsel, Your Honor.
There's no legal prohibition to that.
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. No.
So the purpose then of these specifications just run as between Medtronic and its various suppliers?
With specifically speaking of the capacitor specification, yes.
Right, and I assume there's specs for other
certain
component
other component
parts.
Yes, exactly.
Well.
You know, some things Medtronic is the expert in and has the technique and does in-house. Other things it contracts with contractors, and when it contracts with suppliers, it will provide these specifications that the supplier then has to meet.
Where in the record does it establish that, in fact, these specifications were not part of the PMA?
There's never been a dispute. Plaintiff has admitted in the trial court, and in, I believe in these briefs here in this court, that the specification was not provided to the FDA. And I would direct this court's attention to 21 U.S.C. Section 360E, sub D, sub 2, in which it states quite clearly that pre-market approval is based upon, I'm quoting now, the information submitted to the FDA and any other information before the agency with respect to the device. Here, there is no dispute that this document was not submitted to the FDA, nor is there any suggestion, let alone evidence, that it was ever considered by the FDA. So as a matter of statute, it simply is not part of the PMA. Now, counsel points to 21 CFR 814.9, which he says defines the PMA file as including documents incorporated by reference. There are two problems with that argument, though, Your Honor. First, that's simply the wrong place to look for the definition of what the PMA application is. The proper place to look is the statutory provision I just provided, which tells you what the FDA bases its decision on. The provision that plaintiff's counsel is referring to has nothing to do with the definition of the PMA application. Rather, that discusses what materials that the FDA possesses with respect to a device that has received premarket approval are confidential or are not confidential and therefore subject to public disclosure. And the definition at 814.9, which is the provision that plaintiff's counsel points to, clearly includes things that are not part of the PMA application. By way of example, part of the PMA file under that regulation includes post-approval reports. Obviously, those are not submitted to the FDA as part of the PMA application, so they're just looking at the wrong provision when they say that it was part of the PMA file. And one more point on 814.9, which is what plaintiff relies on to suggest that this is part of the PMA, it says that the PMA file, which again I emphasize is not the PMA application, but the PMA file includes the application and documents incorporated by reference. That's just a one degree separation. Nothing in the regulation that counsel points to allows incorporation by reference through 2 degrees of separation, which is what admittedly we have here. Now, the second point I want to make is that
So then, Mr. Talbert, the idea is that, okay, Medtronic is bound by whatever we submit.
Correct.
But you can't hold us to stuff we don't.
Correct.
And in this case, stuff that's manufactured by somebody else, and, you know, they're making the ultimate capacitor that goes into your devices.
Right. I mean, you know, if we had submitted the capacitor specification to the FDA, the fact that it was made by a supplier rather than us wouldn't be dispositive.
You'd be stuck then.
The dispositive fact is that this simply was not submitted to nor considered by the FDA, and therefore is, as a matter of law by statute, not part of the PMA application, and therefore cannot impose binding federal requirements.
That seems like a big gap to me in terms of the grand bargain between allowing a manufacturer of critical medical devices that carry risk with them, the bargain that if your device is approved and you construct this device and compliance with how you said you would, there would be no liability. But if there's nothing to accommodate for the component manufacturer's liability?
Our position is entirely consistent with the federal scheme that Congress enacted, because under 21 U.S.C. Section 360E, which is the statutory provision governing premarket approval, the FDA has the absolute right to determine whether or not an application is sufficient. So if upon receipt of the application that Medtronic submitted with respect to the Virtuoso ICD, the FDA said, we see you have a bill of materials here. We see this is referring, you know, we see in the PMA application reference to the bill of materials. We want to see what that is. You know, we don't have it in front of us. Please give it to us. They could have denied our application at that point had we not submitted. And then if they had demanded that, they could have said, oh, we see now a reference to this other capacitor specification. We want to see that. The agency had absolute right to ask for that material and withhold approval of the device until receiving that material. But the agency has the unfettered discretion to determine what is or is not necessary for its internal deliberative processes. And in this instance, the FDA was completely satisfied with the materials that we did supply and did not ask for the specification that is at issue today. And if this court looks at the Buckman case that we cite in our briefs, we don't cite it for this, well, we do cite it for this proposition, actually. The Buckman case clearly states that a state law claim that would induce manufacturers to flood the FDA, with submissions that the FDA is not asking for, is contrary to the congressional scheme because it will interfere with the agency's ability to conduct its mission, which is to review materials and approve devices that they believe, you know, satisfy the statutory requirements. And if the FDA is getting tens of thousands of pages per application rather than merely thousands of pages per application, it would simply gum up the works.
So that outweighs the right of a patient plaintiff such as Ms. Delfino to be able to recover for her harm from a component part manufacturer.
Yeah, I mean that is
from
Medtronic. Your Honor, I mean, that is the natural
from Medtronic, not necessarily from the component manufacturer.
Well, yes, Your Honor, that is true. Now, two things to note. First, you know, if there were a violation of the PMA, let us say we delivered an ICD that simply didn't have any of the capacitors that we stated it would have, then clearly she could sue because we would have violated the FDA. So it's not that we're entirely immune from suit if we violate the PMA, but again, here we did not. The second thing to note is even if Your Honor perceives some gap, it's not to say that the manufacturer can get away with anything, because even if a private plaintiff is unable to sue in tort, the FDA has extensive regulatory powers and polices manufacturers very closely. And an interesting point, I don't remember which member of the panel asked, but the question was asked whether their FDA took any action here. And there was a Class 2 recall, which is essentially an advisement, a letter going out to doctors advising of the issues and to monitor their patients. The product wasn't withdrawn from the patients, it's just an advisory. But the interesting and important thing to note is, even though the FDA clearly knew, clearly was aware of this copper issue and the consequences for battery life, it never found a PMA violation.
Do they? I mean, do they have the authority? I mean,
in
Medtronic's experience or in the industry, has the FDA come back after the fact and said, hey, this product, as you've put it together, has violated the PMA that you submitted to us?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I can't point to a specific product from Medtronic's portfolio. I'm not aware of Medtronic ever having violated PMAs. But, no, I'm not trying to be cute, Your Honor. I can't point you to a specific product.
No, I understand what you're saying.
Your Honor, in the decision you authored in Jones two years ago, pointed to the adulteration provision. That would be the mechanism by which then the FDA can enforce that sort of thing.
So is a violation, I mean, I'm looking at some language from the Buckman case that you have to read it a couple of times, I think, to figure it out. But it says a plaintiff must be suing for conduct that violates the FDCA, but the plaintiff must not be suing because the conduct violates the FDCA. And so my question is a violation of the PMA process a legal or a factual question?
I think that the definition of what the PMA requirements are is clearly a question of law. Then the question whether the requirements were violated can become a factual question depending on the circumstances. So, for example, we'd all agree that the PMA has specifications in there where it says it's going to be a hybrid with capacitors. And then the court, it's a question of law, says that is the federal requirement. Then there could be a fact question for a jury. Did this particular device have the hybrid with the capacitors in it or not? That's a factual question. That's not a legal question. So, I mean, there could be a factual question, but clearly the question of what constitutes the PMA requirements is a question of law for the court. The second point I wanted to touch on is the performance standard question, and it's clear that the capacitor specification did not impose ongoing performance standards, because those performance standards can only be imposed by notice and comment rulemaking, which did not happen here. I point this court to the case Walker from the Fourth Circuit, the Klein case from the Northern District of Georgia, which we cite in our briefs, and then more importantly to the statutory and regulatory provisions. So 21 U.S.C. Section 360DB says that performance standards must be imposed through notice and comment rulemaking. And the suggestion that was in the reply brief from plaintiffs, and I think I heard slightly at the end of the argument, that this simply does not apply to Class 3 products with pre-market approval is flatly wrong. And the provision to look at there for that point is 21 CFR Section 861.1 sub B sub 3. And that states explicitly that the FDA may make satisfaction of an ongoing performance standard, quote, a condition to pre-market approval. And it's only Class 3 devices that get pre-market approval. And indeed, statutorily, 21 U.S.C. Section 360E both authorizes the FDA to deny a PMA application, or actually requires the PMA, requires the FDA to deny a PMA application, and requires the FDA to revoke approval had it been granted if the Class 3 device does not satisfy a performance standard. So
was the labeling with the limited warranty approved as part of the PMA process?
The labeling was indeed approved, Your Honor, yes. That is clear. And with respect to the one... The council, I think, wisely chose not to focus on the 5.1-year claim because it's, you know, clearly frivolous given that right on the same page as the 5.1-year state is characterized as a projected lifespan based on estimates, or it's a projected estimate based on certain assumptions. So on the face of the label, it's clearly not an ongoing performance standard, merely a projection and an estimate. Now, on the question, plaintiff, I have only a few seconds left, plaintiff takes a position that if it's not expressly permitted by the PMA, then it's impliedly prohibited. But that position is squarely contrary to this court's decision in Lemaire, in which it said that if federal law is silent as to a particular attribute, then imposing a state law requirement with respect to that attribute is necessarily imposing a state law requirement that is different from or in addition to the federal requirements and therefore expressly preempted by Section 360KA. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tauber. Mr. Becker, you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start with the 14546 specification. Mr. Tauber and I may disagree as to whether it's 1 degree or 2 degrees of separation removed, but the bottom line is it's referenced.
But, okay, let me ask then, just to make sure I understand. The PMA materials, while voluminous, referred to the bill of materials but did not contain or attach the bill of materials.
That's correct.
And so the bill of materials is referenced in the PMA application documents, and in turn that bill of materials lists, among many other things, this specific specification 0114546.
That's correct. Okay. But to your broader point, Judge Bjorkman, there, whether or not that was ever submitted to FDA somewhat misses the point, because a different regulation, which we talked about in my opening argument, requires the manufacturer to tell FDA when they intend to make a change to materials. And I gave you that a little bit earlier. The porous copper that was used was a change of material they got from a different supplier. That was never disclosed to FDA, and all of the policy concerns that you were alluding to are exactly why Medtronic is required to tell FDA when they intend to change materials, which they never did.
Is there some record evidence that shows that they specifically changed from standard copper to porous copper, or did...
So I don't think it's
a bad lot of copper.
I don't think it's entirely clear how they got there. I think what happened, and there is reference, it's either document 36 or 38, talks about in the field, in the subsequent investigation, that Kemet, who's the supplier, suddenly started using porous copper. And
one of several suppliers.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Let's turn briefly to the performance standard issue.
Maybe I've missed Mr. Tauber's argument, but Medtronic never submitted those, and so therefore they're not bound on those changes. They're bound on the changes to things they submitted. I mean, why doesn't that defeat the argument you just made?
Because the way that the CFRs read is that you are required, you own the device as the manufacturer. And by the way, this also answers the question, why didn't we sue Kemet? Let me just give you the reference. On document 30, which is Ms. Willem's deposition at page 101 to 102, there's a passage in there that essentially says, we own the device, it's our device, we rely on our suppliers. So the reason that we sued Medtronic is because it's their device and they are responsible for the conduct of their suppliers. That dovetails into your question, which is this. What got approved was the device, not component parts of the device, but the device. And when you make a change to the device, which can include a component part, you are obligated to tell FDA you're going to do that.
And you're, in your mind, the change is having copper behind the tin over nickel
plate. Well, it's two things. One is that, Your Honor, but the second is when the second supplier comes along and starts using a totally different type of copper.
Bad copper, yeah.
Right. Now, on the performance standard argument, Mr. Tabor and I just flatly disagree. I'd encourage you to go back and take a look at the statute that we both cited to you. That statute specifically says all of this notice and rulemaking requirement applies only to Class 2 devices. It specifically references Class 2 devices. The only mention of Class 3 devices is for Class 3 devices that subsequently get reclassified as Class 2 devices, which this was not. This has always been a Class 3 device. What's more, and I think this is interesting, neither Mr. Tabor nor the Walker majority cite the statute. But the dissent does, and the dissent goes on to point to the very CFR that Mr. Tabor told you, which says FDA can, in connection with premarket approval, impose performance standards in Class 3 devices, period, end of sentence. That is then buttressed against what FDA said itself in the Horn decision from the Third Circuit, which says FDA took a position, we have never, we will never, and we don't have to have rulemaking to impose performance standards. And there is no real dispute that Medtronic failed to satisfy the capacitor drainage and battery voltage performance standards. I'm out of time. Unless the court has any other questions, I thank you for your...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Becker, and thanks to counsel on both sides here. The matter was well and extensively briefed. It's been very helpful to the court along with your arguments here today. We'll take the matter under advisement and have a decision for you in 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.